This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Let's see, because sometimes I lose track of time and we could be here with just a bunch of skeletons. Thank you very much.
Would you like water?
I'm good. Thank you. Well, I hope you're doing well, but I have no idea, and this is not usually the time where we check in about that, so maybe you're not doing well. You never know, you know, when you don't do anything, things happen. Actually, when you do a lot of things, things happen. You can't really get away from it. The mind and the body and the world produce all kinds of things, and some of them are so peaceful, complete, connected. Some feel so fractured and broken, painful. So whatever it is, I'm just grateful that we're here, because somehow being together in this context can be really healing. I have and I just like to, I'm looking in at the founder's altar and feeling so grateful for Kobunchino Roshi for coming here across a vast ocean and planting seeds. And then I can look around and see all these flowers. Of the seeds that he planted. Oh, so, so grateful. And you know, this is, I never knew, you know, Roshi, so, but I know people here, some of them, for them, he was a beloved friend and teacher. To me, he's kind of like a myth. Myths are alive. They're timeless. Just like the actions of any human being. So not only Chino Roshi's practice and offering, but so many people have carried that forward. I have so many dear friends here, people who continue to make it so I can drop in here at Jikoji every year or two and be amazed. And maybe some of you have that same feeling. So I'm just enormously grateful. You know, and one of the things that's very evident to me is that Chino Roshi came and transmitted the embodied practice of moving around this space in a particular way. You know, just the way the bodies move when we're walking, bowing, and when particular activities happen. The embodied transmission of Zen is no joke. You know, that we have this old text that says it's a mind-to-mind transmission, but it's important to understand the context where mind means everything. It's an everything-to-everything transmission. Body, from a Buddhist perspective, is only a body insofar it is known as an experience. It's not an object. How are we knowing your body now? How can we know these bodies not as objects? Something much more intimate. And I think one way is to just be Kobunchino walking around this room in this way that wasn't Kobunchino, because it was thousands of years of other people walking around rooms in the same way. It's like every one of those trees is like totally distinct, but all of them have thousands of years of ancestors that in a certain sense are identical. Inseparable, inalienable, never alone, always supported, always supporting, always receiving, always giving, only and always receiving and giving. If you don't like being generous, too bad. You can't help it. So just get used to it. Get used to it. So I'm supposed to talk about the Avatamsaka Sutra. This flower ornament scripture, flower ornament sutra, is so big, I wasn't sure that my wrapping cloth that someone gave me would wrap around it. It's really good, you know, if you just need more exercise, this is the sutra you want to be studying. It is, in fact, the largest, the longest Buddha sutra. Coming in at about 1,400 pages in English translation of small print. And, you know, I'll talk about the sutra, and then at each one of the talks, we'll also be doing some mode of recitation or chanting of the text together, which we'll get to as we go. So this sutra was basically compiled from numerous shorter sutras sometime in the middle of the first millennium. Probably the earliest sutras that began to appear and then ended up in the Avatamsaka were showing up around the beginning of the Common Era, so about 400 or 500 years after the time of the Buddha's death, around the same time that the Pali Canon was being compiled and the first Prajnaparamita literature was emerging. Everything is empty, so you're already free. A message which for a second might be like, ooh, already free. And then often rapidly is like, I don't think so. What are you talking about, man? So the Avatamsaka Sutra, Flower Garland Sutra, Flower Ornament Sutra, very influential. In particular on East Asian Buddhism. So it kind of birthed its own school of Buddhism in China that became very, very influential, in particular on Zen, which is why one of the reasons I think it's good to talk about here. So flower ornament, Avatamsaka, in Chinese was rendered as Huayan or Hua Huayan, and in Japanese is Kegon, in Korean is Hwaum. And I'm pronouncing all these things very poorly, so I try, but languages are, they're difficult. So the Chinese school that became so influential based on this just called Huayan, so it's just flower garland, the flower garland school. And the style of the sutra may not be to your liking. I don't know how much Indian sutra literature you've read, Mahayana sutras. There are many, the Sharangama, the Prajnaparamita, 10,000, 80,000 lines, the Lotus Sutra, so many, the Srimala Devi. We can go on and on. Anyway, they're very expansive. And florid in style, elaborate. This one is the most elaborate, psychedelic, mind-boggling, overwhelming one of them all, and I will stand on a table and say that. Where you might be like, oh, well, let's describe, one sutra might be like, yes, there were 200 great bodhisattvas attending the Buddha on this occasion. This sutra is going to name them all. In fact, in a little bit, we will all read the names of an incredibly long list of bodhisattvas who are attending the Buddha. If we're going to be like, well, ethics is important, this text will then explain why ethics is inseparable from every other aspect of Buddhism that ever existed for 14 pages, and then be like, oh, and then we have to talk about also, you know, emptiness and expand that. So the relentless unwillingness to stop being creative is very characteristic of this book. But anyway, so sometimes people say, ah, so repetitive. It's actually not repetitive, but it's very iterative. it's very iterative. That is, it's like just like this forest, you know, like boring old forest, tree after tree. Well, it's not a nice way to relate to a forest. Tree, 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 tree. Stupid city, all these people. Person, 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 person. Stupid thoughts. My mind. Mind, 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 mind. Bodhisattva, 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 bodhisattva. Liberative quality, liberative quality, liberative quality, liberative quality. Each one. Can you meet it? The question of this text is, can you meet me? Because I'm really big. And in my experience, oftentimes it's like, no. Ah, oh, really? I mean, so I've read the whole thing, and sometimes it really is a labor of love. And I'll just emphasize the labor part. So, one of the things that I have opportunities to teach now is a commitment to the text, just like a commitment to Zazen, or a commitment to your spouse, or a commitment to the craft of cooking rice. Saying, what happens if I stay with this? What happens? And personally, in my experience, my mind gets blown, and that's good for me because, you know, the thing is, like, when I first encountered the text, I thought, well, just could you just tell me what the teaching is? You know, and then it's like if you try and read, like, Thomas Cleary, who translated this, right? It's like this compact summation, and it's like, who cares? It's like dry. It's actually the expansiveness of it that is the teaching. It's the meeting of its relentless challenging of your desire to be like, could you just tell me what the point was? What a way to meet life. Could you just tell me what the point was? Like when you're with someone and you're, I know the feeling, you know, I've been in meetings in my life and you're like, could you just get to the point? But you know, this text helps me to be like, the point is that I am with you. The point is that I am with you right now. Is there ever some other point? Only in some very small part of my mind that's trying to get somewhere else. So that's a little note on the style. Themes of this text. Well, Huayan is often, people say, will say the main theme is interdependence. And it really, really spools out every possible implication of how things are interdependent and what that could mean that you could imagine. And it is distinct. Early Buddhism emphasizes dependent nature of things through the 12-fold chain, but it's actually quite distinct in ways that I won't get into here. Much more expansive, much more positive. And one of the reasons I teach Huayan, I have a book on Huayan that I'm just finishing, it'll be out next year, is that Thich Nhat Hanh focuses on it quite a bit. So when we see Thich Nhat Hanh's trying to determine how to make and engage Buddhism for the 20th century, which I think is solid for 21st, personally, he draws on two main bodies of teaching, the Yogacara and the Huayan. Because not only are they good about this interdependence and empowerment, which are two themes that he emphasizes, but both of them fully claims to and enacts, including all the other teachings. So it makes room for you to be like, all Buddhists can come in this door and practice together. So interdependence is a big theme, which you may or may not perceive when we are playing with text. Celebration of the sensual. This text is very vivid. There are smells, there are sounds, there are thousands, there are millions, there are billions of tinkling bells of all different varieties. There are banners of all different colors draping from the sky in a ray you cannot possibly keep track of. And I'm not even beginning to scratch the surface of page three. So, sensual experience as the avenue of liberation. This is a main theme of this text, and it is not the theme of many other Buddhist traditions. It is characteristic of the emergence of a distinctly, I think a lot of scholars would say, a distinctly Chinese Buddhism and East Asian Buddhism, which I won't get into too far, in relation to an Indian style. But the seeds, oh no, I'll keep going here. Oh, so the sensual, yes. So actually realizing that seeing things can be the very ground of liberation, not some kind of particular mental state, but just the seeing. All this stuff that I'm saying, by the way, is included. They always base everything in the earliest Buddhist teachings, but they're just kind of emphasizing, expanding, and exploding, and so forth. Another big theme of this text is diversity and inclusion. The end of the text, I mean, there are so many teachers and bodhisattvas in the text, it's incomprehensible. And if anyone ever counts them, it will be amazing. But the end of the text, the last chapter, is about 400 pages long. It's called the Gandavyuha, or the Cleary renders this as entry into the realm of reality. I love this because it's really crazy, mind-boggling, psychedelic stuff. And it's like we're talking about going to reality. We're not talking about escaping to some weird magical land. This moment is really wild. If the part of your mind that has it all figured out actually quiets down, are you kidding me? Like, how is that even happening? Whatever that is. We call it skylight. In the Gandavyuha is the story of a pilgrim named Sudana who meets, I'm not so good with numbers, I think it's 53 teachers. The teachers are incredibly diverse. They include boys, girls, old men, old women, rich people, incredibly poor people, total outcasts, one of them the classic bark-wearing outcast, a whole bunch of night goddesses, which I think is like Dakinis, if you know about Dakinis. There's a mariner who saves people on the ocean. Avalokiteshvara shows up, who's kind of important, and is like just one page after like some 8-year-old kid. So an extremely diverse cast of people: perfumers, a mathematician, a logician, people who teach the Dharma, people who teach just by sitting still and never doing anything, someone who teaches by saying, jump in this volcano and everything will be fine. I don't think we should. So an enormous diversity. And in particular, there are lots and lots of women who are teachers in this text, which is not the norm in Buddhist sutra literature. And just a little side note, Empress Wu is the only sovereign monarch of China in history. And Empress Wu, one of her main sources of authority was she claimed to be somehow tied, I don't know the details, to Vairochana, the Buddha, which is the Buddha of this text. Also, Vairochana, who we invoke when we're going to eat our meal. Vairochana, which is kind of the universal everywhereness of Buddhahood. Anyway, so actually, when this text was particularly prominent, there was a substantial increase in the amount of authority that women had in China. And I don't know exactly what that means, but it's interesting. Maybe they were just hitting people over the head with it. Pay attention. You'd know if you got hit with this thing. There are many sort of just classic Mahayana teachings that are highly emphasized in this text. The two main schools, Yogacara and Madhyamaka, or mind only, and the emptiness schools, are very, you just see the themes relentlessly repeated. The text is incredibly positive in tone. It is really not like the fire sermon in the Pali Canon, which is like all your senses are on fire. Just withdraw from sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mind. It's not helping you. This is like, wow, look at this. Look at that smell, this amazing thing. Enormously positive tone. I like to say the basic idea is a lot of Buddhism prior to the Avatamsaka and subsequent tends to sort of emphasize that what we want to do is learn to detach from the phenomena of experience so that we can be free from clinging. Learn to detach from the phenomena of experience so you can be free from clinging. And then you'll be free from suffering. You'll be more helpful to other people. Really nice. This text basically says everything is so astonishing, amazing, and incredible, and already endowed with everything that Buddhahood is all the time, that you don't need to cling to anything, because guess what? It's Buddha now, and it's going to be Buddha next, and then it's going to be Buddha some more. So abundance, joyfulness, like a very different psychological position to be triggering us to let go. Because why would you hold on? It's just Buddha. There's going to be more Buddha. So enjoy. This is often considered to be a text that emphasizes upaya, which is skillful means, like the Lotus Sutra in that regard. But, you know, in particular, when you look at the Gandavyuha and all the different means these different teachers use, it's like one of them is feeding people. I'm going to talk about this quite a bit in the third or fourth talk. Feeding people. Yeah, feeding people, teaching, meditating, just walking, saving people from storms. Freeing people from prison, all kinds of stuff. Many different ways. Your way of freeing people suffering, turns out, can't be mine. So, what is it going to be? Or maybe I should just ask, what is it? Because instead of waiting to find out what it is, it's like, what is it right now? Okay, so I think it would be nice to read together. So first off, I'm going to pass this thing out, and I'm going to ask you to not look at this during this retreat unless we're doing it. Then you own this thing, so you can have all the fun with you on it later. But not just a bit like, oh, I'll just sit down and read for a little bit, because we're in a session. So we engage with words at the moment of engaging with words, during services, during talks, during doksan, and then we don't. So you can just keep this. So I'm going to pass it out and just we'll do it together. So I'm going to pass these. There's two little packets for each person. And if we run out, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And you can just pass these around.
Okay.
So while those are going around, I'll say if you can keep yours with you, and put it in your chant book, and then bring your chant book with your Avatamsaka flower garland texts to every talk, including the ones up there when we're having the afternoon talks in the communal area, whatever it's called. Okay. So a lot of what I have done when I'm teaching this material is just spending time trying to help people be able to relate to the text without being grumpy, because they're just like, so I don't understand this, I don't get it, it's too, and they, so my first thing is, you don't have to understand it or get it. So now we're free. No understanding or getting. I'm not even inviting you to try for the next 2 days. So what I'm inviting you to do is experience it. And the first mode of experiencing it will be one of my favorite ways to approach sutra reading at first, is just timed periods of reading. So very similar to time periods of zazen or kinhin, or if people do automatic writing, you know, so you just write for 10 minutes. You don't have to figure out what you're writing. You don't stop. You don't go. You just write. Simple. So that's the idea. We just let it happen. And what I think will be nice to do today will be to read aloud. And I'm going to try this approach for today, is that we'll have each person read for a little bit and then pass the next person. So if you don't want to read, you can just say pass. And when we're reading, I'm going to demonstrate, like, you know, I'm into this, so. It might not come across quite like this, but I'm just going to demonstrate the kind of thing. I just turned randomly to a page. There were also countless fire spirits led by such spirits as repository of flames of universal light, banner of universal assembly of light, great light shining everywhere, palace of wonders, inexhaustible light top knot, eyes of various flames, palaces in all directions like polar mountains, sovereign of awesome light, light destroying the darkness, thunder and lightning, all of them manifested various kinds of light, causing the irritations of sentient beings to vanish. So that's a nice way to read so that everyone can hear it. So you don't have to be like, I don't know exactly what this means. Just bring your voice. Those are practicing bringing your voice. The world needs your voice. The world needs your voice. So you can practice bringing it. So I'm going to invite people to read as much as half a page or less if you want. And when you feel like you're done reading, like maybe you read a paragraph, feel like that's fine, you can say, I pass. And then we'll go to the next person. And I might sort of like cue who the next person is. And if the next person is you and you're like, I don't want to read this, you can say, I pass. Okay, are you ready to start? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so you can just hold these in any way that is you like.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Are we reading sequentially or like you did just open randomly and read something?
Oh, we'll start from the beginning.
Okay.
So what the idea here will be to we're reading the opening of the sutra. So this is the beginning. And you can read along with it as people are complaining. That's good. Okay.
Should I read to the last full paragraph or page? Or?
About a half a page is good. But you can just
starting. So okay. Book one, the wonderful adornments of the leaders of the worlds. Thus I have heard, at one time the Buddha was in the land of Magadha in a state of purity at the site of enlightenment, having just realized true awareness. The ground was solid and firm, made of diamond, adorned with exquisite jeweled discs and myriad precious flowers with pure, clear crystals. The ocean of characteristics of the various colors appeared over an infinite extent. There were banners of precious stones constantly emitting shining light and producing beautiful sound. Nets of myriad gems and garlands of exquisitely scented flowers hung all around. The finest jewels appeared spontaneously, raining inexhaustible quantities of gems and beautiful flowers all over the earth. There were rows of jewel trees, their branches and foliage lustrous and luxuriant. By the Buddha's spiritual power, he caused all the adornments of this enlightenment to be reflected therein. The tree of enlightenment was tall and outstanding. Its trunk was diamond, its main boughs were lapis lazuli, its branches and twigs were of various precious elements. The leaves spreading in all directions provided shade like clouds. The precious blossoms were of various colors, the branching twigs spread out their shadows. Also, the fruits were jewels containing a blazing radiance. Pass.
They were together with the flowers in great arrays. The entire circumference of the tree emanated light. Within the light, there rained precious stones, and within each gem were enlightening beings in great hosts like clouds simultaneously appearing. Also, by virtue of the awesome spiritual power of the Buddha, the Tree of Enlightenment constantly gave forth sublime sounds, speaking various truths without end. The palace chamber in which the Buddha was situated was spacious and beautifully adorned. It extended throughout the 10 directions. It was made of jewels of various colors and was decorated with all kinds of precious flowers. The various adornments emanated lights like clouds. The masses of their reflections from within the palace formed banners. A boundless host of enlightening beings, the congregation at the site of enlightenment, were all gathered there. By means of the ability to manifest the lights and inconceivable sounds of the Buddhas, they fashioned nets of the finest jewels from which came forth all the realms of action of the spiritual powers of the Buddhas, and in which were reflected images of the abodes of all beings. Also, by virtue of the aid of the spiritual power of the Buddha, they embrace the entire cosmos in a single thought. Their lion seats were high, wide, and beautiful. The bases were made of jewels, their nets of lotus blossoms, their tableaus of pure, exquisite gemstones. They were adorned with various flowers of all colors. Their roofs, chambers, steps, and doors were adorned by the images of all things. The branches and fruits of jewel trees surrounded them, arrayed at intervals. Pass.
Clouds of radiance of jewels reflected each other. The Buddhas of the 10 directions conjured regal pearls, and the exquisite jewels in the top knots of all enlightening beings all emanated light, which came and illuminated them. Furthermore, sustained by the spiritual power of all Buddhas, they expounded the vast perspective of the enlightened ones, their subtle tones extending afar, there being no place they did not reach. At that time, the Buddha, the world, in this setting, attained supreme correct awareness of all things. His knowledge entered into all times with complete equanimity, his body filled all worlds, his voice universally accorded with all lands in the 10 directions. Like space, which contains all forms, he made no discrimination among all objects. And as space extends everywhere, he entered all lands with equanimity. His body forever sat omnipresent in all sights of enlightenment. Among the host of enlightened beings, his awesome light shone clearly, like the sun emerging, illuminating the world. Ocean of myriad virtues, which he practiced in all times, was thoroughly pure, and he constantly demonstrated the production of all Buddha rays, their boundless forms and spheres of light extending throughout the entire cosmos, equally and impartially. Abbas.
He expounded all truths like spreading great clouds. Each of his hair tips was able to contain all worlds without interference. In each manifesting immeasurable spiritual powers, teaching and civilizing all sentient beings. His body extended throughout the 10 directions, yet without coming or going. His knowledge entered into all forms and realized the emptiness of things. All the miraculous displays of the Buddhas of past, present, and future were all seen in his light, and all the adornments of inconceivable eons were revealed. There were great enlightening beings, numerous as the atoms in 10 Buddha worlds surrounding him. Their names were universally good, Samantabhadra, light of the supreme lamp of universal virtue, lion banner of universal light, subtle light of flames of universal jewels, banner of oceans of qualities of universal sounds, realm of enlightenment of radiance of universal knowledge, banner of flowers of a top knot of universal jewels, pleasing voice of universal awareness, light of inexhaustible virtue of universal purity, mark of universal light, great brilliance of the light of the moon reflected in the ocean, defiled treasury of light of oceans of cloud-like sounds, born of wisdom and adorned with virtue, great light of sovereign virtue, brave lotus top knot, sun banner of clouds of universal knowledge, greatly persevering with indestructible courage, light banner of fragrant flames, deep, beautiful sound of great enlightened virtue, born of wisdom with the light of great virtue. These and others were the leaders. There were as many as there are atoms in 10 Buddha worlds. Pass.
These enlightening beings had all in the past accumulated roots of goodness
along with our Chana Buddha, and were all born from the ocean of roots and goodness of the Buddha. They had already fulfilled various means of transcendence, and their wisdom eye was thoroughly clear. They observed all times with impartiality. They were thoroughly purified in all states of concentration. Their eloquence was oceanic, extensive, and inexhaustible. They possessed the qualities of Buddhahood, were dignified and honorable. They knew the faculties of sentient beings and taught them according to potential and necessity. They entered into the matrix of the cosmos. Their knowledge was non-discriminatory. They experienced the liberation of the Buddhas, exceedingly deep and immensely vast. They were able to enter into one stage according to technical expediency, yet maintain the virtues of all stages, supported by the ocean of all vows, always accompanied by wisdom throughout the future. They had thoroughly comprehended the rarely attained vast secret realm of all Buddhas. They were familiar with the equal teachings of all Buddhas. They were already treading the Buddha's ground of universal light. They entered the doors of boundless oceans of concentrations. They manifested bodies in all places and participated in worldly activities. Their memory power was enormous, and they assembled the ocean of all the teachings. With intelligence, eloquence, and skill, they turned the wheel which never turns back. The vast ocean, where virtuous qualities of all Buddhas entered entirely into their bodies. They went willingly to all the lands in which there were Buddhas. They had already made offerings to all Buddhas over boundless eons, joyfully and tirelessly. In all places where the Buddhas attained enlightenment, they were always there, approaching them and associating with them, never giving up. Always, by means of the vows of universal goodness and wisdom, they caused the wisdom body of all sentient beings to be fulfilled. They had perfected the universal sense virtues.
There were also present thunderbolt-bearing spirits, as numerous as atoms in a Buddha world, known as demigod of wonderful form, banner of swiftness of the sun, light of the flowers of the polar mountain, pure sound of clouds, sublime faculties, delightful light, sound of thunder and great trees, Lion King light, auspicious eye of intense flames, jewel top knot of lotus light. These were the leaders, and there were as many of them as there are atoms in a Buddha world. All of them had constantly invoked great vows over countless past eons, vowing to always draw near to and serve the Buddhas. Their practices, in accord with their vows, had already reached fulfillment, and they had reached the other shore. They had accumulated boundless, pure, good works. They had clearly arrived at all the realms of meditative absorption and had attained spiritual powers. They dwelled wherever a Buddha was and entered into the realm of inconceivable liberation. Taking their place in the assembly, their dignified light stood out. They manifested their bodies according to the needs of sentient beings and thereby pacified them. Wherever there were manifestations of Buddhas, they all went there magically. Wherever the Buddhas dwelt, they always diligently guarded and protected the place. Pass.
All right. Thank you. May all the benefit of this recitation be an offering for the liberation of everyone throughout space and time. Looks just like this place. I'm just going to invite people, if you can remember an image, even vaguely, that you'd like to just reflect back, So you could be like, jeweled top knot, bodhisattva, just picturing someone with like jewels on their head. So anyone who can remember any kind of image, even if it's a little bit vague, and just be like, oh, what was that? You can even look at it.
There was one that was like banner of cloud light. The whole cloud was a light. I really like that one.
Ooh, banner of cloud light.
I think it's because we're in the famous cloud lineage. Pure sound of clouds.
Pure sound of clouds.
There was the tree with all the boughs and the flowers were jewels. Sounds beautiful.
Jeweled tree.
Subtle light of flames of universal jewels.
Subtle light of flames of universal jewels.
Great brilliance of the light of the moon reflected in the ocean. I, reading through this, I kept wanting to see different artists' rendering of all of it, not just like one little thing.
Thank you. Well, there are many images, as you may have noticed. And there's, you know, we've got another 1,300 pages to get through. Thank you for reading. It's so beautiful to hear your voices. And yeah, you know, this is a very religious seeming text to me, you know, having come to Buddhism with no interest in religion at all. I was just like, there's a place where you can sit quietly and no one messes with you in my neighborhood. So I went there. And now here I am. What has happened to me? Because I mean, this is really invoking the power of a religious feeling, which for some people here may be like, they, you don't feel it, or maybe even like, that seems like a bad idea, which all welcome thoughts. But it is the approach. And there can be something powerful about having the idea that there is unlimited compassion, unlimited kindness, wisdom far beyond any way of figuring things out, that is not only possible but available, and that is Buddha, and that Buddha is everywhere, and that talking about that Buddhahood in all kinds of different ways can help us. That's the idea. And you know, I've been around places where everyone grew up being Buddhist, and the relationship of people to Buddha there seems different. You know, it's like when you've had embodied reverence for Buddhists in your household for most of your life, it might be different. Might be like, I don't like that. Kind of like, I know a lot of Catholics who don't like Catholicism, and I know a lot who love it. So, having not grown up Buddhist, it's useful for me to try and take in this very religious kind of language. What can it evoke in me in a particular way? I was in Japan for the first time fairly recently, in April. And one of the places I went was a temple in a small, very small city, not a town, I'd say a small city, that was the abbot. His name is Genyu Kojima Roshi, and he's the teacher of one of my friends, Koshin Paley Ellison from New York Zen Center. So we were there to visit Koshin's teacher, and Kojima Roshi was just wonderful, and his family was really fun. They all lived there, and
It's a little child, so that always helps.
But anyway, we were sitting around and just meeting people and being in the kind of reception area. And he said, okay, well, just so you know, in like 10, 15 minutes, a whole bunch of people are going to come here. And they're coming because it's the week where we open the Canon altar, which is only open for 1 week per year. And people all over Japan make pilgrimages to Canon altars. So people will, I think, if I'm getting this right, people will go to 33 temples and visit the Canon altars. And that's like a kind of an annual thing that some people do, or as a way of kind of doing their practice. You might think, I thought practicing was staring at a wall. Well, it turns out there's a lot of ways to practice. So anyway, he's like, these people are going to come and we're going to do some chants, and then they'll go. They'll get their book stamped that said they visit our temple with the whole stamp. So we went in and we got to chant the Heart Sutra with the folks and share some bows, and then they left. But there I was in the room with the Canon altar, which is really only used for this particular function. And I was looking into it, and our Zen Center has like an altar kind of like this. We have a kind of a hybrid Tara Prajnaparamita, female bodhisattva, on altar, and a candle, and a little thing with some lavender buds to offer, an offering cup, and some flowers. But I've been to many temples in East Asia where the altars are a little bit more elaborate. So this one was like, and I'm often like, oh, so ornate, you know, kind of, oh, this is too much. So anyway, I was looking into this thing, and it's got Canon is way in the back. It's almost dark. There's like layers of altar pieces. So there's one, I don't know what they all have. One has some offerings on it, and one has stuff that the officiant might go beyond that in a special ceremony and offer some incense, and then there's something else. And way in the back, and like the Canon is back there. And then if you look, you can see actually there's 33 Canon statues lining the side that are in it, receding to the horizon. Every one of those was an offering from a temple where Koji Maroshi has a friend. And then there's all kinds of other stuff. There's, you know, the big flower, golden flower things. So anyway, I'm looking in here, like, I can barely even see. Canon is so deep. What's going on? And then I was like, oh, it's the Avatamsaka Sutra. I'm looking at the world these sutras present, which is a world that is replete with an unbelievably, endlessly receding horizon of beautiful things, every one of which represents compassion, freedom, well-being, wisdom. So this made a lot more sense to me. So I looked in there, having looked at a lot of altars, and finally was like, oh, I see. I got to wrap up this talk. I'm just going to tell you a couple of things. I'm going to be emphasizing the three sutras that are the most famous from this, that all of which arose before the Avatamsaka was compiled, and which then became the most influential ones. So the 10 Stages Sutra, the Dashibhumika, is many, many texts refer to it. It is the most quoted line from this text, which you see all over East Asian literature, which is the triple world is mind only. The triple world is mind only comes from that text. What that means is a whole other thing, but the 10 stages is kind of wild, because it's like the first stage is utterly mind-bogglingly amazing. And then it's like, well, that's pretty good, but you really should keep going. And then the second one is really utterly mind-boggling. And then you run out of superlatives. So, do you feel like your life is limited? Do you feel like your capacity for getting free kind of has some kind of limitation? Do you possibly not even know that you're limited in ways you're not even seeing? I am. 10 stages in this sutra are really inviting us to be like, can we continually see that there's something way more open that's already here, but that we can open to if we let down the part that makes things small and controllable. Our mind wants to make the world of things to control. It only makes illusions. The whole world is mind only. That's the meaning of that. Okay, so Purifying Practice Sutra, we'll be talking about this afternoon. This is a sutra that's just a bunch of invocations that when you're doing a very simple daily activity, you do it with the idea that everyone would be free from suffering. Mm-hmm. And actually, like, we have these numerous elements of Soto Zen liturgy come right out of the purifying practice text. And, you know, if you've ever done a hand washing gatha, that's like me all being briefly while I wash my hands. Mm-hmm. So actually, that's the earliest layer of the Abhidhamsaka. So the philosophy of the Abhidhamsaka that tries to present a world that's so amazing that we should take care of it all the time comes first from the invocation to do each thing like you want everyone to be free. So it starts from activity, basic daily life activity, and the philosophy emerges. Lastly, the Gandavyuha, which I mentioned before, the entry into the realm of reality, which is the narrative of Sudana's amazing pilgrimage to meet 53 teachers, all of whom are extremely various in their approaches and personalities. And so we'll talk about that one. So for me, all these are timely. The teachings, it's about taking care of the world, realizing how each thing is connected to every other thing, realizing the diversity of people's needs and practices and identities, the unlimitedness of each person's possibility of helping, with no one left out. These are messages that I need, and I don't think. So I'm looking forward to more of that, but more importantly, I'm looking forward to just putting down all these words now and just moving through this incredibly beautiful place and taking care of our bowls, taking care of each other by letting each other be. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.